In the NBA draft in 1984, I think it was, Michael Jordan was third or fourth in the draft. The guy that was the number one draft pick was a guy called Hakeem Olajuwon. Nigerian guy, played football back in Nigeria. And then I think he's a sports teacher and said, look, you should probably try basketball. And a year later, he's on the plane to Houston and played his whole career in Houston. So an NBA, one of the NBA greats he was known as. Anyway, this guy said, "Is the guy wants to speak to you, Hakeem Olajuwon?" I obviously didn't really believe him at the time. Mm. Left it a couple of days. And then we contacted him. And sure enough, it was a guy, his daughter had come to university in Birmingham to do a business degree. And like, oh, I'd love to see what you've got going on. I was looking at setting some basketball stuff up while I was here. We kind of embraced the day, whereas I think York just struggled a little bit. It was the opposite. We put them out of sync right from the start. They led once after the first, they had the first shot of the game, but they didn't lead again. And we were like really dominant all the way through. So it was a really strong performance. But I was absolutely shocked at how excited the kids were to be meeting a professional sportsman. But they wouldn't know. I could have taken somebody, put me in a tracksuit and told me it was anybody. It didn't matter to the kids. They were so excited. And if the players engage in, you know, and you give a few free tickets away and, you know, bring your parents and they come on a Saturday night or a Sunday afternoon then, and the player that engages them on the match night or acknowledges them, that can mean the world to the kids. And like I said, it is, they do treat them as heroes.
Hero story, couldn't it?
You know, and I guess, you know, I know the players, I've known a lot of the players since they were youngsters, and our import players, obviously I have a daily relationship with them. So I know they're just human beings and just normal guys, but to the kids and the fans, it's
superheroes.
Yeah, and I think we've got to do more of that.
Before we get into this, we're doing over 1 million engagements a month, but most of you aren't subscribed. If you enjoy the content, hit subscribe and follow us on socials. It'll make such a massive difference. Cheers.
Good morning.
Morning.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, man.
Thank you for the invite.
You are very welcome. West Brom fan, as you said, so tears beyond the smog. Or
yeah, for far too long since I was a nipper, really. Since I think 77 was my first game.
Wow,
shows my age a little bit, doesn't it? Yeah. Cyril and Laurie Cunningham.
Yeah,
and, Norwich. Norwich at home was the first game that I ever went to. 2-2 draw, and my dad took me to. And then coincidentally, I suppose, in 2012, the last game I went to with my dad was against Norwich.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he passed away a couple of months later, yeah. So it was a full circle. So we thought, for that game. No, we lost 1-0.
Oh,
lost 1-0.
Couldn't even do a favour.
No, absolutely. No, he was a, you know, I knew he wasn't well, because we always used to stay to the, we always stay to the end, but it was like 10 minutes to go. He was shivering, but that's another story. He's kind of like... Yeah. He wasn't well.
It's a nice circle, though, isn't it?
Yeah, he's a nice circle. So I always look out for Norwich at home, but I don't think we've beaten them since. So maybe I should do away with looking for good luck omens or omens of any kind, I think. But anyway.
So yeah, can we get a bit of an introduction as to your role and you as yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. So where do I start with this, really? I did 12 years of banking, believe it or not, and didn't enjoy any minute of it really at the time. But I played football as a kid. I played, then kind of got into basketball from around 12, 13. Started doing some coaching when I was maybe 16, 17. I set my own club up down in, like in the Northfield really, where we a bunch of mates that we had nowhere to play really. And getting into a club with probably older men at that stage, we felt ancient, but we're probably very young, really.
Yeah.
So we just ended up setting my own club, and I don't know. That was probably my. Maybe I kind of got the. That's when I probably just learned a little bit about trying to get organised. If it's not there for you, go and do it yourself. And I started doing a little bit of coaching on the side with Old Birmingham Bullets. Had a bit of success with that, and then so actually another guy that worked. He works at the Blues now. A guy called Paul Virgo. Paul, he's in the community team here. He was lecturing at North Birmingham College at the time. And I've known him on the basketball circuit. And we'd gone over, this was, it's been 99. We'd gone over to see a mate who was working on cruise ships from Miami around the Caribbean. And Paul was doing the football, some football camps in LA. So I just flew over there and we met up and we did a week on this cruise and then back to Miami for a week, which was great. But he told me he was looking for to run a golf academy at North Birmingham College. He said, but we've got no sign-ups, which didn't surprise me really. You know, you're kind of in the inner city and maybe golf maybe isn't a prominent sport for young people. And I'd said to him at the time, look, if that don't work and you fancy doing the basketball one, let me know. And he rang me about 2 weeks later and said, we're knocking the golf on the head. Could you get me a 5 or 6 students and we'll give you 12 hours a week? And that's what I did. I got some kids that I was working with anyway. I got a relationship and they were looking for somewhere to go to college and did there. And I jumped from there and started there and did some coaching. I got a little bit of work at Birmingham Uni, some stuff there. I picked up little pockets of schools coaching. Yep. Kind of turned that into a job really. And my dad at the time, he'd said he was old school. He was like, well, you know, you got a job for life in the bank in the end, he said to me, as long as your mother's checks on the table at the end of the month, he said, I'll support you. And that was it really. So jumped into that from there, got involved a little bit more on the strategic development side through a job with the council in 2001. And the club then was really initiated by some funding from Sport England.
Yeah.
The Birmingham Bullets had just kind of tailed off and gone into liquidation. So there wasn't much for kids going on. And a little project formed, Active Sports, it was called at the time, just to kind of put some recreational basketball sessions on around the city. So we did one over in King's East, one in Handsworth. The sports centre at Neatras up the road had just been built. I think there was one at King Edward Aston School. There were about 6 of these sites around the city. And I kind of started that off and I was a bit surprised really because there was probably 25, 30 kids at each site. All the old first and second year 7 and 8, I think it was at the time. Brought them all together, the better kids together on a Saturday morning up at Neatras. We suddenly got like 60, 70 kids from nowhere. So I thought, well, maybe these better kids need to be competing at or have an outlet for competition. Yeah. So I entered the team into the national leagues and that was really the formation of the club. Year on year it grew. We had 140 kids, I think, for a tryout a couple of months later in the June. And it's like, oh, actually, I need to probably put something together here now.
Why?
And that really was the start. I think it was City of Birmingham Active Sports was our first year because it was funded by them. And then we took the Active Sports tag off. Year on year, we're getting more kids through the doors. I think maybe probably 7 or 8 years later, we got a pathway from under 13s to under 18s, a couple of teams at each age groups, probably dealing with maybe 150 kids.
Was there just no one from Birmingham competing at a decent level at that time once the Bullets
had gone? Not to begin with, no. There were a couple of little pockets of teams that were running. They were doing some quite nice stuff, but a little bit more maybe niche and smaller. It was a Birmingham A's, I think, as they started at the time. So we had some good competition with them, but they didn't run maybe quite as many teams as us, a little bit smaller. So it was kind of like, it was nice because you saw, I suppose there was a market for it. There was a need, there was kids wanted to do it. And then we experimented a little bit with satellite hubs and centres, and trying to move that around a little bit with mixed success. But the sports centre, the basketball, it's more a basketball centre that's at Neatras and everybody wanted to gravitate towards there really. But the nicety of that was that you ended up with kids from Northfield, Solihull, Handsworth, Aston Lascelles, Chelmsley Wood, all coming together. So
and centralised.
Yeah, and it ended up, I mean, again, one of the best things for me with it all is that you kind of, I suppose, the transition, the social movement, or the socioeconomic movement, where you're getting kids from more salubrious areas and mixing with kids from not so. Yeah,
kids that wouldn't normally.
No, I think sport helps to do that. It's probably one of the only vehicles that can successfully do that and bring communities together. So it's kind of the diversity of what we've got. You know, if we fast forward now 15 years, the diversity of what we've got still reflects the city, which is probably the thing I'm most proud of, really, in terms of that. It has its challenges at times, and finding, you know, financial models that work, continue the existence. But from that kind of thing, there's aspirationally now the kids have got a pathway that they can either come just because they want to blow off a bit of steam and they like the sport and find out, you know, what it's about. But there's also the opportunity to go to the highest levels through our pathways. So we've got teams.
How hard was that to scale from opening a club to where you are now?
We've kind of gone, not easy. I've gone backwards and forwards a little bit. So we're working off volunteer staff to begin with. And to create the culture across an organisation as you grow is quite challenging, because otherwise there were times where I felt, you know what, we've maybe got eight teams, but it's like eight clubs within a club because each coach is doing their own thing. There's not a lot of consistencies, not just on the court in terms of, you know, principles of play, but you've also got the off-court culture and stuff as well. So that's been a little bit of a challenge. We got to a point where I think maybe 5 or 6 years ago, it was when the junior program felt too big. So from a performance level, we scaled that back down a little bit and said, right, these are our principles. So I want to see it on the court, but we also want to get it right off the court as well. So
that's given like a framework then that they've got to...
Exactly that, yeah. So, you know, otherwise, again, without getting too technical, if you've got one team playing one way and the other team playing another way and you want to move a kid through the pathways, you're confusing them, really, absolutely. Yeah. And the coach development comes really relevant within that as well. So the scaling up in terms of the numbers hasn't been too challenging, not on the boys' side anyway. But getting a consistency of delivery has always been a challenge. And I think will always remain a challenge. You know, we deal with a mixture of volunteer, part-time and full-time coaches and staff. So you've always got challenges there on what people commit to, what's a priority for them. But ultimately, the kids and their parents are still our customers.
Yeah.
So when they're coming through the doors, all they're interested in is that their kids getting the best experience and the best deal, really. So not an easy one, and does take a lot of work to get that right. But I think, you know, I'm confident we're kind of moving in a good direction with that now.
Is it similar to football where you would be kind of a feeder club as well, that people would come in and then say, oh, you get scouts at the game and...
Yeah, not so many scouts. The structure of the sport in this country is where it needs to be, if I'm being totally honest. If you go across Europe, you'll see some of it's integrated, like football clubs and basketball clubs and volleyball clubs are integrated as one. But the sport's really much more popular across Spain, Greece, Italy, Portugal.
And the States, obviously.
Yeah, the States, obviously. But our structure here is not particularly good. So there is a little local league now they've got across the West Midlands for kids. The coaching badges, I think, in my opinion, are too easy to get.
Yeah.
So you can get a level one coaching qualification really in probably, I don't know, they've just changed it recently, but for many years it was like a couple of weekends and you can do that and off you go as a level one. Level two maybe was probably 4 or 5 sessions to attend and be assessed upon. But if you compare that to what you're looking at across Europe especially, you'll be in training for a year to 2 years before they'd let you loose on a bunch of under eights. So they're much, much stricter in there and the technicalities of it. So because of that, again, the youngsters aren't probably getting some of the foundational top level stuff that they really need to move on to the next level. So I think there's an area there as a sport that needs to be addressed. From a pathway point of view, obviously we are the biggest club in the area now, and in Birmingham we're the only club that are playing in the Premier National Leagues. So you've got under 14, 16 to 18s, boys and girls. Under 12s is a little bit more regionalised, and then each league has also got a regional conference league. So there's a number of clubs in Birmingham now that play in the conference competition. And we have a team of our own in those leagues. But then the Premier Leagues, which we're in, which is, again, for a pathway point of view, most of the stronger kids will then gravitate because they want to play at the best level. What we need to do is make sure that our coaching levels and infrastructure matches that as well. And again, not always the easiest So the continuous professional development of the staff is something that has to be a priority really for us.
Yeah.
So tell us about the inaugural BCB trophy.
Well, so before I get to that, I'll give you a little bit on the pathway maybe of how we arrived there, which might be an interesting one for you. So for probably, do we get to probably about 12 years, we were purely juniors. And then we were losing a lot of kids at 16 that wanted to go off and play at a better level around the country. So we've had several high-level athletes that have come through. Miles Hessen was a great bar school kid that started on our active sports program, and then went on to become the Great Britain captain. So he's played around the world. So you've had a number of kids that have come through, but then left us at 16 because we couldn't fulfill their ambitions. So the thought process was, how do we retain kids in Birmingham if they want to or they need to be here? And then what's the outlet at the top end? So the first motive really in putting a men's team together was to give the kids an experience. So we played in the fourth division and it would be majority a bunch of 16, 17-year-olds just to get them into the adult game.
Yeah.
And a bit more physical and
competitive,
smart players. And then we set an academy up. So first of all, did some work over at Solihull Sixth Form. And we put an academy in place there where the kids would do maybe 10 hours a week of basketball alongside their academic studies. We've managed to evolve that now. So now we've got an academy over at BMET at Sutton, which is probably our elite academy. We've got 62 kids there, I think, at the moment. They're doing up to 19 hours a week. And then they play in the top team playing the top level of Wednesday afternoon basketball across the country, and it's called the EABL. And we've got kids that are doing a diploma in sports alongside their academic studies there. So there's some high level athletes there. But just before COVID, we got to the third division. I was still coaching then as it was my last year of coaching. And we managed to get promoted up to the second but COVID was the best thing that happened to us because it was a bit of a chance. You know, I'd kind of gone from being running the club voluntarily to running it on my own to having a little bit of support. But you having so much time and you're kind of heading the day-to-day stuff.
Everyone furloughed up then, wanting to.
Yeah, because, you know, you're trying to run what's on the court all the time, but then you lose sight of the infrastructure. We've got stuff in schools going on. We've got a couple of like community hubs that we're running. We'd started the academies. But finding a financial model that actually worked was never anything I even thought about. And during COVID, I'd got a couple of board members that I put together. But it was a time to stand back and say, actually, where do we want this club to be? Realistic now, because we've got
day to day. You're just trying to go, what's going on tomorrow, and you're not looking at the bigger picture.
Totally. And it was too big really for me to be carrying on coaching. It's like, well,
swimming in it at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. But swimming backwards really, or sinking, and you're kind of thinking, well, I'm going to have more impact probably not by coaching one set of 12 kids, but by actually standing back and helping others grow and getting the right people in place. So what does an infrastructure look like? And then how do you work that into a commercial model as well, really? So you've got, on the one hand, you've got your charitable objectives, but on the other hand, you've got a business that needs to operate and run. So we'd already had there was a guy that had contacted me. This was a couple of years before COVID, and he'd come through one of our volunteer coaches. A guy had gone into an immigration solicitor's on the Stratford Road, where one of our volunteer coaches' wives worked. And this guy said, oh, I'm American, I'm a Nigerian guy, I play basketball, I've just arrived in Birmingham. Now, in the NBA draft in 1984, I think it was, Michael Jordan was third or fourth in the draft. The guy that was the number one draft pick was a guy called Hakeem Olajuwon. Nigerian guy, played football back in Nigeria. And then I think his sports teacher had said, look, you should probably try basketball. And a year later, he's on the plane to Houston and played his whole career in Houston. So an NBA, one of the NBA greats he was known as. Anyway, this guy said, there's a guy who wants to speak to you, Hakeem Olajuwon. I obviously didn't really believe him at the time. Left it a couple of days. And then we contacted him And sure enough, it was a guy, his daughter had come to university in Birmingham to do a business degree. And like, oh, I'd love to see what you've got going on. I was looking at setting some basketball stuff up while I was here. That's where we met him, and it was like, you know, oh, this is really good. And got five boys aged 5 to 11 at the time, just into football, really. The one especially was a big footballer. Never seen their dad play basketball, never knew anything about his career. He's like, come down on Thursday night and we'll show you what's going on. And he came down. Oh, this is really good. Oh, the boys would love this. And so brought the boys on the Saturday morning, and that was it. He was hooked. So this is like this big NBA star. He'd come and turn up with his kids. They'd never picked a ball up before. Be on the sideline. They definitely got no idea who he was. And he's showing them kind of all his stuff. So,
but that just come from my phone call.
Just from a phone call. It was really bizarre. So he was living over in Solihull, just arrived. And he became a director with myself and Kirk, who's the three of us now, directors, Kirk Dawes. And so he was here for 3-4 years. He still sits as a director with us now, actually. He's back in Houston. His boys have grown and they're all at college and on their own careers, really. But on the back of that, he was the guy that said, what do you want to do? We said, well, we would love to have our own academy here so the kids don't have to go away. And so we put his name to the Solihull Academy. That was a starting point. And we'd love to run an international summer camp. We got a lot of our kids that will go around, you know, even overseas to camps in the summer. And so we put this week-long camp in, put next to us, and just used some accommodation from Aston Uni. We had about 90 kids in for the first camp. But he'd come down, he was there every day with them. And that camp is still running now. So we run it over at Bromsgrove School now, which is obviously, from a facility point of view, is amazing. But we get 160 kids for 2 weeks of the summer. They come from Spain, Ireland, Italy, all around the world again. But that was, profile-wise, obviously, from our perspective, it was huge, because suddenly we're in like an, you know, in at that age then, he was still pretty old enough for the younger generations to know as well.
Yeah.
So you're kind of in an international spotlight, which was amazing. So COVID, fast forward to COVID hitting, I got an email through from the gaming company 2K. We've seen what you're doing and your contact with Akeem. We are a foundation in the US that does core renovations. They do like outside YMCA's facilities in the States, and they glam up the courts and put a bit of seating in. But they said, but we've got a global foundation now, and from the UK, we'd like to apply to the European arm to see if we might get some money. Would you, you know, if we did it on your behalf, would you be happy with that? Well, absolutely, of course.
No, I wouldn't be interested in that at all.
Yeah, go on then.
The challenge at the time was Birmingham City Council, because it's their facility, as you can imagine. So we had got control of it. Anyway, cutting through all the bureaucracy, eventually we kind of got on the same page on that. And about 3 weeks later, they said, right, well, there's 100K for facility renovation and 30-odd K for some community projects, because we like what you do in the community. So we had bear in mind, we got like a two-court badminton center, really, in terms of like basketball courts on both sides. So it was a few stand. We used to have a few sit down seats around the edge. That's what you could do for an arena. So it was, if you got 100 people in there, that'd been a good day, really, not usually. So we had a show court stand right across the middle, the first one of its kind in the UK. We had some heavy duty baskets brought in, some bleacher seating, and some nice international scoreboards. And the council then said, well, actually, we'll do the lighting out for you now. So it was used to be like very ambient orange, yellow lighting, old school leisure centre stuff. So again, obviously now fluorescent light comes in. So it's made it like a little bit mini arena, so we can get about 500 in there on match nights. And that obviously helps us with our planning. It's, well, we've kind of got something a bit higher profile here now, aspirational for the kids and probably the pinnacle of the pathway. So rather than building the pathway up and, you know, from top down, we got the foundation of the junior program that had already got at that stage maybe 15 years kind of behind, integrity behind it. But now we're putting something special on the top. So we got this, at that stage, come out of COVID, we're in the second division. A lot of the lads that had left to go and play around the country have said, we want to be part of this. You know, it's a nice arena to play and we want to represent the city. They all came back. And we've got a bit of a five-year plan. Let's get the men and the women to the first division. And we kind of did it in about, we did it within 2 years, which was a little bit, again, too quickly in one respect.
I was going to say, is that like a gift and a curse then?
Yeah, it was brilliant because the guys that we brought back was, you know, and some of them are still with us now in the BCB. Really, really, really good and committed lads and great to be able to get them in front of the home crowd in Birmingham. So, you know, it was really, really inspiring to see some of those kids that most of them have been through the club's programme at one stage coming back together to play. But infrastructurally wise, again, real tough one when you're then at that level and suddenly the market in what was the first division at that stage, so it was a National Basketball League Division One, the market changes and obviously you're bringing in players then that are going to get paid. You need to practice more, you need to get your infrastructure much more professional. Yeah. So we did 2 years in the first division and we finished ninth each year. So top eight go to like the playoff at the end of the season. And then this year, in last summer, we kind of had another review. The league had, so it was it's a Basketball England league, so a governing body run league was the NBL Division One. The clubs in the league felt it needed commercialising because there's no prize money, there's no incentive for being there. You're really just putting a budget together for your players and hoping you can cover it with sponsorship and crowd income. Yeah. So the clubs decided this deserves to be commercialised as a bit of a British entity. And in essence, have formed the British Championship Basketball League. This is the first year of that league, but it is the same clubs that, you know, from Division One to do it. So when we looked at our roster in the summer and how we went about stuff, I think we felt the culture needed to reflect the club. So rather than it, you know, we're very, very aware of, we've got a community program, we've got a schools program, we've got a big junior program, we've got an academy, we've got our camps programs. How do you knit them all together? So actually the crossover, you're not running five different organizations within one, really.
Yeah.
And so we looked at the culture, we revisited the culture and the values, really. And we've always been quite strong on the values. Integrity, I think I mentioned earlier, has always been a key one for me in terms of, let's not sell a kid a dream. We're open, we're honest, and we give them what we say we're going to give them. We need to be consistent on that. Because so many kids, I think, get sold a dream and that for me never sat right. The respect, which kind of crossed over from the respect of officials, the respect of each other. Basketball lends itself really to discipline. So you kind of find whatever background the kids come from, when they cross the line into practice, as long as the standards and expectations are the same for everybody, wherever you're from, and we're fair, I think that tells should tell a kid the story or give them the understanding that I need to behave in a certain way.
Because I imagine with the kids that you probably attract, similar to football, I assume, that a lot of them are not from that kind of family background where they're taught that kind of thing, or maybe not.
So no, absolutely.
Kind of
yeah.
Discipline like martial arts, where you bring them in and say, okay, this is this. Yep. Like it Olympic kind of.
Yeah, we get a really good mix, which again enables that crossover and people to learn from each other, really. And I think that's quite unique and quite special. But there are plenty of kids like that that don't have the parental support. There are plenty of kids that have got it as well. And even that you have to manage at times in the right way. But the important thing for me is that our coaches don't, you know, again, do you favour a kid? Everyone says they don't favour anybody. We all favour the kids that work the hardest. Let's be honest about that. But not just because I'm talented, or if a kid's in terms of practice, I don't want you picking him over somebody that has just because you think he's a better player and you're going to get a win on the weekend. Mm. We've got to go beyond that because I think the lessons.
That's rife in kids' football.
Yeah,
it's absolutely rife. And it's terrible. But then I understand the pressures then that come with coaching a team, and then you've got to look in yourself and say, what do I want? Do I want?
Well, you understand being a successive person as well, don't you? You don't want the owls on your than you, or if you're from a personal point of view, you want
when you're in competition with the other coaches, aren't you, of the other teams, then there's the short-term gain of, I'm going to pick the better kid that can't be asked to come training.
Absolutely. And again, winning breeds winning, and you're going to get parents that see a winning team and you're saying, oh, I want my son to be part of that, or daughter for that matter, I want them to be part of that, but not understanding probably what the lessons that maybe that particular coach is trying to teach them. And even within our club, it's a challenge because that's without losing the competitive element. And I always say to the coaches, look, the development comes ahead of the winning, and it's a byproduct, really. If you develop the kids effectively, the byproduct is we're going to win.
Yeah.
But of course, match day comes and they're going to try and do all they can. You know, are you going to take a kid out with a couple of minutes to go that the game's on the line?
To give the kid minutes.
To give a kid minutes that hasn't played.
The game.
But what message are we sending, you know, collectively? Because that kid that hasn't played any minutes might be a kid that's going to develop more further down the line.
Yeah.
But if they're, you know, them and their parents are probably saying, well, actually, what am I doing bringing my child?
Such a hard balancing act, isn't it?
Yeah,
it is. And it's really tough on the coaches because the coaches, I think now the parental expectations are getting more and more as well in this day and age. And as we spoke about social media earlier, it's like, you know, everyone's there for their child. And I totally understand that. So setting out the goals and expectations at the start of the year with the parents and constant communication, I think, is vital. You're never going to conquer all of it, but I think
saying, like, I'm working on the same amount of subs as the next person.
Absolutely.
I think moving a lot, just what we speak about off camera, back in the day, there's a lot, especially in schools, there's no winners, there's no losers. You've got to take that into consideration, what kind of era we're in, haven't you, to a certain extent. It's not back in the day where you just do anything to win and just be horrible and just...
No, times have changed, haven't they, in that respect? And, you know, I remember when I started coaching, you'd have kids travelling around the city, but a lot of them would be on the buses on their own. And it was tough for them to get there. They valued what they got. Mm-hmm. And you didn't have to, as a coach, demand effort. Whereas now it feels like, I guess, the resilience in the young people is... That's changed for me in the past few years. And there's still, don't be wrong, we still have got kids that are very resilient. But there are some there that, you know, am I going to be accountable, responsible if something goes wrong, if I don't do this? If a coach raises their voice at somebody, as we all can out of frustration, you know, do we then get on the coach's back for that as a parent? Or do we accept that, actually, I put my child in this environment, they're going to be competing with others. You know, we can't wrap them in cotton wool if they really want to, at a performance level, if they really want to push on for the rest of their lives. So it's a, that's a...
It's a juggling act.
That's a, it is
a juggling act. You teach them life lessons, aren't you?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, kids recognise that as they get older. It's just, you know, naturally, parents want to protect their children, don't they? They don't like seeing them.
Again, it's a balance as well, isn't it? Because then, you want your child to learn the lessons and you want them to do better. But,
Really.
Same time, it's
You don't want them to get turning up every week and getting bollocks and bollocks. But at the same strength, you don't want them to kind of not get anything from it. And we've had on the podcast before, players going to their agents saying, I don't like someone saying, work harder. But what? Don't like that. If you was 20 years ago, that would be a.
Have been locked.
That'd be a compliment.
Washing machine, you know what I mean? Lads.
So yeah. It's like a fine, but again, it's what they want to get out of it, isn't it? And
absolutely. And you know, again, in our respect now, the BCB team and lads, I mean, if you're going to make it into that group with the senior players, they're going to hold you accountable. You know, if you're a junior and we've put you up there, you've got to be strong enough to be able to deal with that. See, if you can't, you're going to fall apart. And that's the end of that there, really. So anyway, we got ourselves into the first division, as I said, and we did a couple of years where we just missed out on the playoffs, which I think was probably a good thing in hindsight. And when we looked at this year, it was very much about the values. So resilience, respect, integrity, and then we use the word unity as opposed to teamwork, because it kind of unifies off the court with the communities, and on the court we felt you need to be unified as a group. So we work off those four values. And we recruited people probably ahead of the athlete. And it was only a couple of significant signings that have made all the difference to the rest of the group. So We brought an American lad in Ron Blaine, who's been around the leagues a little bit, but just brings a winning mentality to the group. Excellent on the floor, but doesn't mind losing and holds everybody to account on that as well. So he's been great. He's brilliant in the schools and in the community as well. Represents the club really, really, really nicely. And so he's very extrovert, I would say. So he's the guy that, you know, if he wasn't on your team, you'd hate him. He's one of those guys, he would wind you up as an opponent, but when he's with you, you know, he's great to have with us. And then we have another lad, Eric Donaldson. Eric's dad was Dick Donaldson, played for Birmingham Bullets back in the late 80s, early 90s. So Eric's from Coventry originally, but then has been over in Denver and Colorado in his kind of later years, played in Brazil for a season. And his dad reached out, wanted to come back to the UK and play. So we managed to sign him, and Eric's the opposite. He's introvert, but he's like your blue collar worker. He's just like solid in every single department. But the influence those two have had on some of the other guys, you know, we've already got a couple of guys that had a really strong mentality anyway. So it wasn't difficult for them to buy in. Martin Gale's a Birmingham lad. He's been, you know, probably the face of Birmingham basketball for 15, 20 years and leading 3-point scorer in the country. So it didn't take anything to get Martin on board with them. Martin actually coached us to the second division title as well. But you've got another couple like that. Orlan Jackman was a Commonwealth Games gold medalist. So he's living in Wolverhampton now. He was playing down in Worthing previously. So it came to us, but loads of experience. And then we kind of mixed that in with some, I guess, some younger players. Zach Powell, again, was a great bar boy, came through our program as a kid, gone off, played in Ireland, was down in Reading, and then we re-signed him to the group. And then another local lad, Lucas McGregor, had come across from, he was playing over in West Brom, but he's really matured. So real nice balance now of youth and experience, really.
So the players then are saying, you know, tell us about your experiences, and they can just reel them off. Okay, well, this is the situation that I've been in. And
Totally. And there's some really nice stories within that as well. We've got, so there's another kid that came through the program, Faris. Don't get many Asian basketballers, but he's a real big role model for the Asian community. He joined us at 12, quite a late developer in his basketball curve. But from 16 onwards, kind of his curve and trajectory went wild. So he's been great as well, because he's still fairly young, but a lad that knows the club and the fabric of the club. We got a lad that was at Birmingham Uni, Luke, that was up from Kent, didn't pick a basketball up until, I think it was his second year at uni. Went over to Portugal, was a grabbing high jumper. So he's about 6'8", 6'9", but leading shot blocker in the league. So he's made a huge difference. And in 3 years, his game has just come on in leaps and bounds. And then the coach that we brought a coach called Charles Smith, who played for Newcastle in the British Basketball League for years, was probably one of the greats really within that league for, I don't know how many trophies, and he'd won across the period of his career, but much of his career was in Newcastle. And when we were looking for a new head coach, I was kind of notified he was available, and we brought him in. And again, because he's been there and done that, he has a really great way with the players, but the players know when he's talking, the instant respect is there.
Yeah, he can talk shop.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, he's got a really good, you know, persona look. He's laid back in his way, but his preparation, and when he does talk, the players hone in and listen, really. So we try to professionalise that as much as we can, and that's been a challenge in terms of going from even second division, when not a playing budget, we pay a bit of travel, but that was it. And then suddenly you've got a playing budget, okay, albeit part-time and doesn't get anywhere near football budgets, but it's still a different beast in managing that commercial arm of it now. But it's been a really phenomenal journey to this year. And I'll go back to your question that you've asked me about the trophy final. We started the season, we thought we got a solid team. You know, last year we got people that could score, but maybe we felt on occasions that the team ethic wasn't quite where we wanted it to be. But these guys knit together right from the start. And the way the BCB trophy ran was that you start in a group stage at the start of the year. There were four teams in our group. We won all those three games. I think it was Milton Keynes, Nottingham, and Hemel, I think, were in our group. So they're all well-established clubs for those three from around the country. And we kind of beat them pretty well. And so the early signs were good. But the way our season works, some of the import players will come in to different clubs a little bit later. So you're always wary early in the season. Teams get a little bit stronger as the season goes on. There were a couple of university-based teams that just take a while to bring their senior players in and gel. But when we got to November and we were still going pretty strong, you kind of begin to wonder, where might this go now? Yeah. So the only I suppose frustration we played the semi-final back in October of this cup, and they don't run the final till the end of March. Wow. Such was the schedule. So that was a little bit of it, because obviously the players are focused all year, they've got that in their mind.
It's hanging over you a bit, isn't it?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But the league form remained pretty consistent as well. So when we got to the final against Yorkshire, who we'd lost to at home but beaten away, you kind of thought this could go either way. But on the day, so the coach, the game plan they put together, and you know, from a strategic point of view, basketball were very much about, they'll spend time on the scouting report around what are the tendencies of players. I'm sure it's the same on the football pitch, but
yeah.
What does this player like to do? What they like to do? What are we going to try and take away from them? Where do we feel we could hurt them? And the coach will have, I can't really speak for Charles, but he'll have permutations of who's on the court at any given time and which of our groups may be strongest against them, where we can hurt them. And the game plan on the day, our players were, we kind of embraced the day, whereas I think York just struggled a little bit. It was the opposite. We put them out of sync right from the start. They led once after the first. They had the first shot of the game, but they didn't lead again. And we were like really dominant all the way through. So it was a really strong performance. So it's a great day. We had about 300 people travel up to Nottingham, which for you know,
brilliant.
Which was really nice. So the little like maybe had about 750 in the hall of the day. But I suppose it kind of brings it home. You put 20 odd years into,
I was going to say,
to get into that point, yeah. Really. And
the esteem then of, you know, even, so how does that look then, Europe-wide, globally, that you are the inaugural winners of this competition?
I'll go back to the setup of the sport in this country. There's been quite a lot has gone on with the governing bodies over the past 12 months in terms of FIBA, which is the equivalent of FIFA, give the license out to what was the British Basketball Federation, who can then license professional leagues. So when we moved away from the governing body, the Basketball England, which, believe it or not, are not the governing body, they're like a home county, they're classed as,
right.
Home County Association. When we moved away from that, we had to get a license as a league from the British Basketball Federation to run this year. At the same time, there's a Super League basketball league, which is a franchise league with a pretty hefty entry fee to join it. And it's arena based. But they were in dispute with the British Basketball Federation. So there's a bit of a kickoff going between those two. We got our license from the British Basketball Federation. Just before the season starts, FIBA put a vote of no confidence into the British Basketball Federation. So they're no longer running licenses. So our league was a little bit, well, where do we sit? And they're still going through the process now, I think, of restructuring at the top end. But things like visas for overseas players, registrations, licensing, was all kind of like, well, where?
Up in the air.
Where does all, yeah, up in the air. So the sport itself needs a bit of an overhaul from top to bottom, just to get itself in the right place. There's, you know, participation-wise behind football, it's pretty heftily played from kids, but the transition into clubs are a bit more expensive. It's not like with a football pitch, I guess, where you can put a couple of posts down and off you go on a park. You're generally talking about hiring a facility,
yeah,
which this day and age, if you're getting something for £35-40 an hour, probably as good as you're going to get. A couple of hours for a game, then you're paying your referees and whatnot. So you're probably talking for a game these days, for a junior game, in the region of, what, £130-140. And when you maybe got the home team takes all the fees on, if you've got 10 or 12 players, it doesn't make that particularly expensive yet, especially when as we talked about earlier, some of those inner city kids that you want to be able to play, you don't want to price them out the equation. But at the same time, have you balanced up making sure it works financially, which is a challenge. So from a sporting perspective, we're, in theory, our league is like the championship of football. Are we ever going to go to the Premiership, which is the SLB? We'd certainly need a financial backing to do that. I can only say that maybe 2 years ago, they were looking at a franchise fee of around £2 million to go into that. It's obviously not something we have, because we've built from a community base.
Have you had any discussions with anyone down there?
Not yet, but getting in front of the right people is something we've been trying to do. We've had some discussions with the Birmingham Panthers that the Blues are supporting, obviously. We can see the synergy, for sure. I think it's just meeting the right people, in honesty, to make that happen. It's something we're very, very open to. Because our kind of short-term plan is to, you know, we get about 400 in every game up the road at Nature's. We can't get a lot more in than that. There's maybe another 20%. We're in talks with the city of about potentially taking over the management of the facility, because they're trying to reduce their overheads as a city council. So it's something we've had preliminary discussions about. And again, from a training venue and what we could do there, I think it'd be quite interesting. But long term, the plan would always be how big could we get? Because, you know, looking at the facilities that the Knighthead Group are looking to build in the future, the American influence of the sport.
Yeah.
I think there'd be a lot of synergy, I think, in making that happen. So it's certainly something we're interested in doing.
Just find the right people. It seems to be that the closer the sports quarter comes, it's more apparent that it's not just for us to go and play football there.
Yeah.
It seems to be that maybe that's the plan all along, that all these bring all these other sports in. It's a sports quarter, isn't it, for the city?
Absolutely.
That makes perfect sense.
And it would be a really exciting development. I can go back to when I was a kid and Birmingham Bullets used to play out of the indoor arena as it was then.
Yeah.
You know, and they got up to 12,000-13,000 people within there. So I think the appetite could be there if we can get it right again. You know, we work really hard on the match night experience at the moment, and you know, there's still work to do, because we're operating on primarily a volunteer workforce on match nights. You know, it's right from setting the seating up and changing it from looking like a leisure centre into an arena. You know, we got to a certain level and we're only going to be able to get so far within where we are, because there's not capacity for more seating.
So that was one of my questions just from the off. So I think when I was in school, I think I went to one or two Birmingham Bullets games, and it was a big thing. It seems to have, I don't know if it's because I've got older, but it seems to have just fallen off a little bit. Basketball. What do you think? Do you think there's room for Saudi money in kind of a live type basis basketball? Do you think rule changes would help? I mean, it's obviously, we look at snooker and stuff these days with the new 8-ball and an extra.
Yeah.
Is there ways that we can kind of make it more appealing to youngsters?
I think there are. It's interesting that you say that. They've toyed around. There's a lot of 3-on-3 basketball that goes outdoors now. You know,
street basketball.
Yeah. So the challenge in this country is obviously the weather and the climate, because you're probably going to get 3 or 4 months out of that. And the governing body did a big piece of work after the Commonwealth Games in, I don't know if you've seen, but they've stained 20 courts around the city with a kind of a purple paint, really, and really appealing for kids to go and play on, and they've done backboards. So that's worked really nicely. The challenge with that, as I say, is that you're maybe going to go from May through till September with that, and then afterwards, unfortunately, the rain kicks in. You're going to get the hardy people that will go and use them all day, all year round. but you kind of struggle after that. You know, rule change wise, I think it's interesting. We run a 24-second shot clock, so you've got 24 seconds to score when you pick the ball up, and that's pretty global now, apart from in college in the States where they're still using a 36-second clock. So the idea of that is you can't just hold the ball and waste time. And the feedback we get from, you know, and our audience will be, there's a small core of the basketball community that will come to all the games, but we get a lot of families and parents in for the first time and kids. And the challenge is, do they understand the rules at times? What are they coming for? So actually, when the basketball stops, what's going on in between those times? What can they get from the shop? You know, what food have we got on offer? All those peripheral entertainment things, which you'll see in American basketball. If you go into Europe, because there's a bit of a history of competitive European basketball, it's a bit more like football, where it's more tribal. Right. So the fans in the stadiums will be very much there because it's their team playing. And we're caught a bit in between because we want a fan base that's going to follow us. And, you know, we're making some really small strides in that, but we've got the core of fans every year is growing. The season ticket holders are growing. We're getting a small core of people that would come to away games, whereas before nobody would come. So that's a little bit of a work in progress on that, because you're trying to build your fan base. And, you know, we've got two or three guys that, there's one guy that runs our supporters club, and they'll make a day, but they jump on the train, just like you would to a football game. They're on the beer all day, get to the game, and they love it. It's their release and their Saturday, really. Kind of look forward to that. So you've got that type of fan, and then you've got your audience that maybe will want a more family friendly experience. So we probably do that blowing our own trumpet better than most in our league, but there's still a lot more we can do. You know, where do I find a budget every week for cheerleaders for the halftime entertainment? Almost like leaning with the universities or partners that maybe want the exposure. Say, yeah, we'll go and do this for nothing. We get to play in front of an audience, you know, influencers. That's kind of, because our budgets are minimal. You know, we work on bringing probably about $2,500 on a match night from ticket sales and the secondary spend. But to put a match night on is probably about 50, you know, we've about $1,200 a night.
So fine margins.
Well, yeah. It's fine margins, yeah. And that's vitally important to the lifeline of the budgets for the season. So you only need a bad night where, you know, if we've got it wrong, and we did a game on Easter Sunday, which we had to because we had no more time in our schedule, but the crowd was well down. And suddenly, you know, we lost about $1,000 on the night. How do we recover that back? And that's kind of the day-to-day challenges we have. So real careful scheduling. You know, maybe we've done a lot of games on a Sunday this year, so it doesn't clash with the football so much.
Yeah.
But also it's maybe people know, right, 5:30 on a Sunday, that's when the Rockets play. I could put that in my schedule. Whereas we traditionally got on Saturday nights and 7:30. And again, that I did that because of my experience back in the day, the Bullets used to play then. It was a lovely Saturday night. But if I think about it in modern day now, if people are off on the pop for the Saturday night, kids, okay, it is a Saturday night, but you're still not going to get youngsters home to bed till probably 10:30. Would that put you off? So it's trying to minimise all of those things and saying, well, what's going to work for us moving forward? I don't think the sport itself at the moment will make any probably fundamental rule changes. But I think the speed of the game and the athleticism, maybe people come to that. And the beauty of our place is probably you can almost touch the players. So there's a good feel, you know, after the game, the players will talk to the kids and they're doing all their autographs. And the parents love that closeness, really, that maybe when you move, if we do ever get to an arena, you might lose a little bit of that, but we've got to make sure that we don't lose it. Yeah. So that you can still touch and feel them as human beings. And the players are great like that. Win or lose, they take the game face off and they smile and they do the pictures with the kids. And so that's
massive, isn't it? That's what you've lost with football now at this level, isn't it? Non-league is still, you've still got that connection.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, that's kind of, from when we were younger, even with the football, you'd see the players out, or you'd be able to see the players after the game. It's very little of that.
Yeah, they're human beings, aren't they?
Yeah. Parents still do now. They still wait outside for the players. Yeah. They might be waiting a bit longer and stuff, but some of the players come out, don't they? And so you've still got hundreds of people wanting to do that. It's just that.
That's for human kids. Element. You meet someone or you meet an idol. That makes your life, can't you? That can change the trajectory in life.
Yeah, and it's funny you mention that because we started this year getting, I've tried to get the players more and more into schools. So we'll offer the schools a free assembly visit, for example, and then I'll do I or one of my colleagues will do a Q&A with the kids, and then the player will tell them about their experiences. And I was absolutely shocked at how excited the kids were to be meeting a professional sportsman. But they wouldn't know. I could have taken somebody, put me in a tracksuit and told me it was anybody. It didn't matter to the kids. They were so excited. And if the players engage in, you know, and you give a few free tickets away and, you know, bring your parents and they come on a Saturday night or a Sunday afternoon then, and the player that engages them on a match night or acknowledges them, that can mean the world to the kids. And like I said, it is, they do treat them as heroes.
Story, couldn't it?
You know, and I guess, you know, I know the players, I've known the players, a lot of the players since they were youngsters, and our import players, obviously I have a daily relationship with them. See, I know they're just human beings and just normal guys, but to the kids and the fans, it's...
superheroes.
Yeah, and I think we've got to do more of that to sell the people, the stories of the person, really.
Yeah.
So you see a huge difference.
And you just touched upon it there. So boxing's had a massive, with the influencers and the celebrities and stuff, boxing's gone mad. Is that something that you could look at and get influencers kind of 3-on-3 as a basketball, and you could go down that road of doing a bit of a Misfits basketball game?
Well, there's a lad on social media, isn't it? The Greek Cypriot lad.
Oh, MK.
Yeah, he goes around the world.
All of his stuff.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay. That's so, very engaging, isn't it? Because, again, you've got a little bit of needle all the time, haven't you?
Absolutely. And we've got... There's quite a few little basketball, I say little, there's quite a few basketball influencers. And it's one of the things, I met with somebody last week about that, actually. We were talking about match nights and whether we could get two influencers together to do like a one-on-one at half-time, because you're then engaging their audiences into what you're doing. So it's something definitely moving forward that I think we've got to be really creative in what we're doing
Bring audiences in. Back in our day, Harlem Globetrotters and stuff, just the whole...
Yeah, the aura of them,
circus,
wasn't it?
Circus, weren't it?
Yeah. So, you know, if I look at them now as a basketball person now, you just realise how ridiculous some of it is.
Yeah.
But again, as a kid, and you know, they're still touring. Yeah. I think they've toured continuously for God knows how many years. But I think that extra stuff that needs to come in. So we've got a great DJ now that keeps that going all night. The MC really engages the crowd, which is really, really important. It's them visuals now. So what, at halftime or... You know, you'll have timeouts in basketball where there's a break. You'll have your quarter breaks, which are a couple of minutes. Half time's about 15 minutes. The players will probably go off for about half of that, but you've maybe got the other half to fill something with. So it's finding times for that. So cheerleaders, obviously, a couple of dances and will go down well during the period of the time. But then the entertainment. So we tend to have the kids on the court and I'll do some shooting competitions and stuff. But I think trying to work with influencers and artists and giving them opportunity to perform as well.
Yeah.
It's probably one of our ways forward. And, you know, it's like anything, you've got to get it organised well in advance, promote it out to the audience.
Get them to promote it. Yeah.
Totally.
But again, it's a fine balance between what they want X amount to what you're going to kind of get it back. And exposure is brilliant, but it's not paying the gates. It's not paying the players. No, so you've got to...
And then you run from, you know, we've still got to run the core business. You've then got to run your match night entertainment, which is a job in itself, really, if you're doing it properly. So it's finding all those people or volunteers that either need the experience, because they might be a university student that are going into event management, something like that, or want to perform in front of an audience, like I said, dancers or singers even. Just trying to mix all that up and keep it fresh. And then obviously the food that you're bringing in, we're a little bit limited at the moment in that we can't cook on site. So we have to bring hot food in, but we're talking to people about food trucks and that kind of stuff.
It's all food and all that kind of
stuff. It's all that additional stuff, you know, where we're exploring next year, whether we might be able to do something with the Bermuda Panthers netball and do a bit of a netball game followed by a basketball or vice versa. So we can kind of work together and share audiences.
Yeah.
I think, you know, when you're in,
or mixed charity game, something like that. Like.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, the media coverage that we get is limited, and that's
I was going to say this, because my daughter's playing netball, so I'd see quite a lot of netball. But even with, off the back of women's football, that was massive, weren't it, following the Euros. And then from that, then it's kind of fed down. The netball gets a lot of Sky coverage.
Absolutely.
We don't see anything for basketball, do
you? No, they haven't got that right yet, the leagues, if I'm being honest with you. I think the, interestingly, I met a guy last week who is involved at Sky Sports, and he's a basketball fan, but he's at the moment, it's just the market and the products isn't quite right to bring on there. And basketball, we haven't got it right, you know, and I'm quite positive about, like, even now, we're just starting to get our merch better, and on match nights, people come to the games, they'll buy their merch, and the branding around the little arena now is looking, there's more and more Rockets shirts and stuff, which is encouraging for me, because that's a mobile marketing tool, really, isn't it?
Same, yeah.
But from the sports perspective, you know, you might go to a basketball game and you walk out and the shop's packing up, which is exactly the time where you want to be buying stuff, probably. Yeah. We've got to get little things like that right. And then on the court, the infrastructure just isn't there. So this SLB league that I spoke about, which is the fully pro league, it's arena-based. There's only 9 franchises in there at the moment, which, no relegation, so there's no jeopardy there. And I think we need to, as a sport, we maybe need to look at the football model and say, well, actually, we'll tier it maybe 1, 2, 3, 4. You can get promoted if you meet a certain criteria to get to the next level. I mean, you know, at the moment, if at the top league you need to be at arena based and
facilities
and 2,500-3,000, for example, you've got to meet that criteria to get promoted, but the opportunity's there if you win that league below. Whereas at the moment, we could win the league this year. Well, we didn't. Reading won the league, we finished third, but Reading couldn't get promoted just because they won the league.
Yeah.
And the same below us, really, as well. It's,
well, we have a few of that with the national leagues in football, just going towards that. If you haven't got stands, or if you, it's not, if you're still 4G, or if you, you've got to have certain things to be able to get onto that.
You need that peril, don't you?
Absolutely. You know, absolutely. I mean, what they did this year with our league, the BCB, was the first year, the clubs that took the initial step in setting it up, and it's cost us more money than we did with the governing body to try and get some infrastructure in place. They ring-fenced that for 2 years just to get them clubs the opportunity. And then they're looking at, I think, from next year about demotion, which I think, like, the jeopardy, it has to be there. It does have to be there, because otherwise, you know, what's the point? Because you're going to get to the end of the season.
And the incentive to get
totally
up there.
Well, obviously, yeah, in America, everything is franchised in that way, isn't it? There's no jet, but that's the product for them, isn't it?
Yeah.
Over here, I imagine most of your fans are going to be half football fans as well.
Well, getting back to that, you know, I guess, what are we really as an entity? One of the things that surprised me a little bit, I thought when we started off and going a little bit higher profile, that actually, you know what, people just come for the experience. It's a good night. It's exciting. You know, a lot of the games end up being quite close because, you know, especially in this league now, there's some good teams in our leagues. You know, if you go to sleep with anybody, they're going to hurt you, whether they're the bottom team in the league or the top team. But when we were losing games last year, the crowds dipped off. And that was like, okay.
It's a sign that
the winning does matter. People want to be associated with something that's successful. You know, so yes, you're going to have your core of fans that will be there, whatever's happening. But a lot of those people...
Those fickle fans as well.
I'm going back a few years now, but somebody said to me, they were talking about the Blues, and they reckon that probably the fan base needs to be 5 or 6 times what the stadium holds to be anywhere near filling it every week. And it's a pretty good analogy, really. You know, so, you know, we need to build towards that, to making sure. I mean, the basketball community will be well known, but still getting out there in the wider public, people will still say, oh, I didn't know that team, that club existed.
Well, even with the success of your win, I didn't really see anything even on the news. I think there was no...
We got a little bit on BBC, you know, and I think they did like a 30-second slot. We did a little bit after the game. We got a little bit on Radio WM leading up to it. But getting that
Where's the lens today? I know, with the cameras.
Exactly. He did, to be fair, Nick Lutherell came down and did a piece pre-game. And I said it was about, we got about 20 seconds after the, just to celebrate the win afterwards. But that was it. And that kind of courage is crucial to us, really. Yeah,
a big kind of
profiling it.
Blue like, again, I've won a cup. Or
the thing with Brom,
win a cup. Yeah, you want to go, oh, come on, let's celebrate.
Well, regardless of, I know you said, you know, with it being that the competition progressed, but still, I was looking at, I was reading one of the websites for research and the same. The name's on it forever. Birmingham are the first inaugural winners.
Yeah, well, you know, we look at, if I look at this season, you know, if we've finished third in the league, we've won the cup, and we're in now, after Saturday, we're in the semi-final of the playoffs. So couldn't really have had a much better season, really. But you know, getting that, even to the city council, getting that out, we're representing the city, and we're getting a little bit of buy-in from certain individuals that have been really good in recent times with us. But it's still kind of in that, you know, we don't get support from the city in terms of financial support. And it's that stuff that's my day-to-day challenge. How do we continue to exist?
It's chicken and the egg then, isn't it? So if you're getting that media, then people are getting involved in kind of sponsoring. Absolutely. And then sponsoring will get you more high profile. And
The thing is, that much bad news around the council and the bins and everything, isn't there?
You'd think a good news story.
Well, like the Chamber do the Brumbassadors, don't they?
Yeah.
They were down there doing that, trying to shout about Birmingham and people in Birmingham. You're flying, aren't you? Absolutely flying.
No, absolutely, and that is so. It's a frustration on one end, and it's something on the other. You kind of look at yourself. How can we make sure that they can't say no to kind of putting us out there? Really, you know, it's been this season's been an amazing season. But behind the scenes, you've always got that. I've got to pay people next week. Yeah. Where's the money coming from? That stuff that maybe people don't see. Sponsorship wise, again. The structure of the league doesn't help us because the profile has to be improved, and you know all of the games are streamed through the league's streaming channel, but getting more eyes on that is crucial probably to the overall sponsorship. We've got some really good sponsorship support, but we're still probably only about a third of where I need that to be to make our budgets work effectively. We have to, you know, get players to work in the community on certain things. Our academy underpins, pay some of the coaches' salary. You know, the gates aren't, if we're a little bit short on the gates, on the projections, that has a big, big impact. So there's a number of things that go together.
So forecasts obviously rely on.
Absolutely, on
That being a consistent thing.
Absolutely, yeah. So, you know, that's the sleepless nights when you get, you know, whatever's trying to enjoy what's happening on the court and we're doing well, you know, is sometimes difficult. And that's why the final, getting back to the final day, you know, for that day, you kind of just have to put all of that other stuff out of the way and just enjoy it for what it's worth. And the euphoria of that and just seeing the players, what it meant to them as well, I think. You know, it's kind of like for us as a club, it's 23 years of graft to get to that. And that was never an aspiration when we first started off. It was always kids stuff.
Yeah.
But since when we kind of made that decision just around COVID, this is where we want us to go, I suppose, at that point then.
That's, and again, the trickle down then, the kids seeing that.
Absolutely.
It's going to be more of a sell, isn't it? Oh, yeah. I want to be and do
it's
what they do.
It's totally. Not only what you do in the community, especially for inner city kids who wouldn't get these opportunities. But then, that culminates up to are champions.
And I want to be on that pitch doing what they're celebrating and doing what they're
absolutely. Doing. And I mean, the beauty for us is that we've had two players from the academy that have been on that roster this year. We had one last year. So there's an Nectarius who was... He came to one of our recreational sessions, development session, when he was 12. And has just last the start of this season, gone back to Greece and signed in the second division in Greece. So he's kind of come on leaps and bounds, went to City Academy. You know, pretty tough upbringing, really, from where he was at. And then another lad, Larry, this year, again, he came in from Germany when he was 12. He was probably 6'7" and built like this at 12. But he's been on the roster and at the academy and again played in the first team this year. He's off to the States in the summer, so life changing for him. There's another Greek lad, Phil, that's off to Spain in the summer, 17 at the academy. So those things and those stories are probably as important to us as the first team. But then again, with the conversation with our media lad every day, where do you position your media? And putting that out there, the first team obviously is the high profile stuff for us, but the stories underneath from the young people, they are feel good. Yeah.
So how does, obviously you've got the connections with Europe and America. So where does this go in regards to, look, you said maximising the commercial opportunities for the club. Can you go do tours of America, play some of the bigger, how do you?
That's a good question, really. Because again, it's all budgetary. You know, you could go and do those things. We looked at, you know, we were going to do a pre-season in, we got a partner club in Alicante. We're going to go to Alicante and do some 4 or 5 days there. But then again, when you budget it and work that through, at the stage we're at right now, it's like that's going to come out of our own pockets if we're going to do that. So a lot of it revolves around sponsorship. There's no doubt about that. That's the commercial challenge, finding the right partners and sponsors that, and one of our issues right now is that some of the, finding the right size of business, really. We won't be big enough for some of them in the profile that we're going to be getting out there. And then for the smaller businesses, a lot of them are quite happy to support the youth programs and put money into that. But it's like, I've got to show people and demonstrate what value they'll get from being involved and having their name on the front of the first team shirt or the sponsorship that comes with that, or sponsoring match nights. You know, we've just... gonna have to pay for this, but we've been LED boards and on the match nights now to kind of enhance the match night experience, which is really nice, and there's a load of advertising space on there. But the commercial world is something that is quite new for me. I've gone from the community background and coming through that angle.
And it's a different animal completely.
It's a completely different animal, yeah, learning selling and also selling your value and recognizing what your value is. Because it's been spent years and years and years about how do we just cover cost to make this happen? Actually,
say yes to everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And now it's actually, well, what's wrong in us making money on that? Because it's going to, you know, we should be able to make money on that goes back into the team or into the group. And so they're not going to travel on. The first time I've got to travel on the mini bus when we go to Nottingham because it's a short journey, I can get them a bigger bus. But, you know, right now, every penny. It kind of has to be.
You ideally need a sponsor to come in and say, okay, there's the money for this season, and then say,
absolutely,
what are you going to do with it? So you haven't got to worry about that money then. And then you can concentrate on the socials and getting bits and getting the profile of that up. But who's going to put that money in if we're not, if we're gambling on kind of
where
it come from? So it's like a bit of a.
Yeah, it's a
funny one,
isn't it? It is a funny one. And it's also probably the fact of getting like multi year deals as well. So you know, every summer, last three summers, what budget are we going to have this year? I'll speak with the coach. Who can we afford? What can we go after? What can we do? And it'll be a lot of, most of the agreements in basketball will be 1 year because we haven't got budget in place ahead. And that's one of our challenges. How do we, just for stability and long-term sustainability, how do we get that budget and say, right, we know it's all covered this year. If anything else comes in, great, but it's also covered for the year after. And the year after that.
So let's get our heads. So we don't need to worry about that. That's
totally.
Yeah, how do you run a 5-year plan when you don't?
Totally.
Can't fund a 5-year plan, Tom.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's going to be some, there'll be core funds that we know we're going to bring in. We can, I suppose you can project what a conservative estimate on what a gate might bring in and how that transmits into your secondary spend. But outside of that, the majority is going to be through sponsorship. Or have we got schemes that the players can work on in schools or in our academies where we can pay them through there. So it comes back to that long-term thinking again and trying to get people's heads around that. And it's peanuts really probably to some big companies, but it's just demonstrating actually what's the value, what's the social value, or the commercial value, somebody being involved with us really. And that's kind of one of the things that we're working really hard. And we have some really good commercial or small partners. The you know, MacArthur Glenn up at Cannock, the guy, the general manager there, Dave, he's a big basketball nut. So, you know, he sits on our advisory board, but he's also there, the front of shirt sponsors. We've got a lot of in-kind sponsors that will arc media over in Sutton, will do all of our visuals for us whenever we want to do.
I know that boys, yeah, Graham.
Graham and Phil. So they're, so they've been as good as gold, but, you know, we go in there and we'll do that. But it's probably the Royal Navy. One of our players is a Royal Marine, Jordan, and so the Royal Navy came and put some their recruitment budget into it because they hadn't got a footprint in diverse communities. So that's been great. But they're 1 year really generally. And it's like I said, it's getting back to that stage. How do we How do we get people to say, right, I'm with you for 3 to 5 years?
Like, so it's trying to get that Saudi money in it. So we're like, okay, yeah, let's have a bang on that and see if it works.
That's it. You are the champions, aren't you? You are the champions.
Well, we've got a lot to sell there, because the flip of it's going to be, and I'm fully aware of the conversation already, the players are going to come back and say, well, we've been successful this year. We've got offers elsewhere. I'm going to have to, you know, I want a little bit more money. And I can't knock them at all for that. If I was in their situation, I'd be doing exactly the same thing. But we've got to then go and have the conversation about, well, this is what we can afford. You know, the off season, although it, you know, which will be, depending on how we get on next week, season could end next week or it could end the weekend after. You know, you're straight into negotiation time then.
Yeah.
And new season, pre-season will probably start mid-August. So you've only got a 3-month window.
Yeah.
But there'll already be other clubs.
Well, again, if you're a savvy SBL owner or something, you'd be looking at clubs like you thinking, this player's good. We'll just tap them up and we'll...
And you know what?
You've got nothing to kind of...
None of it all I'm back with. And I think we're still at that position now. If the SLB came calling for players, I mean, I'd be saying to the players, if I think they're ready, you know what? Go and do it, get your exposure, because that's probably the next part of your journey for where we are right now.
Yeah.
But we've got some really good BCB level players that I know other BCB teams are going to be coming in. And that's what we don't want to lose them to other clubs in our league, really. Mm-hmm. You know, we've already kind of started back November about what does next season's recruitment look like and where do we think, which players do we really think we want to retain? Who do we think is going to go? So you start that really early. But at the same time, with our budget being in place, it's quite hard to have some of those conversations about
moving forward. You want to keep hold of your strongest players.
Absolutely.
And build upon that.
We've got a core.
It's a fine balance.
Yeah, and basketball's got this history in the UK of being a one and done. And we don't like that at all. But at the same time, from a business perspective, you know, Kurt Dawes, the director, is very much on that. I don't want players 1 year at a time. We've been pretty fortunate. We had 6 or 7 of last year's roster that returned, but we had one on a 2-year deal and the rest were all 1-year. So it was just by the grace of God that they wanted to come back and stay in Birmingham and be with us. But
if you've got a budget, would you be able to put them on a 3-year contract? So if people were to come in, then you could ask for a fee. And
that's the difference. Yeah. I mean, transfer fees, it's. I think there are release clauses and stuff that you put in. I mean, generally, the basketball world, because most clubs operate on 1 year, there's not a lot of transfer fees go on. But if it was somebody that, you know, an SLB club came in for and said, you know, we want this player to go, well, we could say, well, actually, we'll release him, but it's X amount to do so, yeah. So it is about that longevity, really, and that forward planning, because once you've got that, let's say, that takes all your woes away. You can just worry about delivering a great product. Whereas you can imagine at the moment, a lot of my head is in the financials every day. You know, have we got this coming in? Have we got that coming in? Where can we make a bit more money? Where can we save some money? And our infrastructure is actually bigger than 99% of basketball clubs in this country. In fact, bigger than most SLB clubs. So we've got 8 full-timers now, 7 part-timers, and then a load of volunteers as well. Whereas a lot of clubs would still be running out of 3 or 4 people as a max. In fact, even in our league, you've got a lot of clubs that have maybe got owners that have got other businesses. The coach might be a full-timer and they might have a player or two that they've got. Usually they're import players. Yeah, passion product. Yeah, exactly that, passion projects. So we're well-placed in that stage, but at the same time, extra commitments for us means extra pressure and budgetary pressures more than anything, really. So,
yeah. So just kind of wrapping up then. So if someone from Birmingham's hearing about the Rockets for the first time, someone a bit older who used to like the Birmingham Bullets.
You ain't going to get that. Birmingham Bullet. You're too short and you're too old.
I'm good at threes, yeah. So why should people kind of get behind the club? Why should people get involved in the club? Kids and families, kind of what's the sell?
I think the sell really is, look, it's a true representation of the city. I think there's the demographics that we have cover north, south, east, west, and socioeconomically as well. The players are predominantly Birmingham lads that are Birmingham based. So there's that real close knit feel, I think, to being part of the fabric of Birmingham. And we're very big on, you know, what do we want? We want to represent the city. We want the grit, the resilience that, you know, we know as Brummies that the city is kind of synonymous with. You know, and they're performing on a national scale. They're highly skilled. The game is exciting. So it's up and down. At the moment, it's very affordable. Our tickets are, you know, in comparison to probably what else people are doing, is very, very cheap. But the excitement of what's going on in the match night experience, I just encourage people to come and have a look. First of all, we always say that. Come and see what it's all about, get hooked, and then we move from there. You know, it's not something we're competing with football against or an other sport. I think it can be done hand in hand. You know, whether you're a Villa, Albion, Blues fan, the idea would be you could still come to the basketball and still support your team. Mm-hmm. But I think people would be pleasantly surprised if they actually got down to a game, even if they've not followed basketball before, to see what it's all about.
What we were talking about before, weren't it? Football has become very stale and sterile, hasn't it, in its way? It's not very swashbuckling. It's not very exciting currently. I don't think any of the clubs right in the Midlands are providing that kind of football. So probably a nice antidote to that as well.
No, I'm not going to run football down while I'm on here because for obvious reasons. But I think the beauty of...
We were talking about how the game's changed, hasn't it? It's not very... Yeah. End-to-end attacking, is it? It's very...
This is different.
No, absolutely. And it's so, you know, the sport is, it's fast-paced. The majority of the British Championship Basketball League is based around British players. So you can have up to three imports in. We've got one American lad in, but the rest are all Birmingham lads Wolverhampton that Gorlow's from, but they're localish lads. So it's something that I think, you know, you can touch, you can feel, you can be part of. Especially for young families as well and stuff, it's, you know, you've not got there's no fear of what happens on a match night. We're going to be worried about anything like that. It's, you know, there's no outgrow or anything. So it's...
Fans aren't scrapping on the
ground. No, the fans aren't scrapping. There's that atmosphere is very different to that. So it's very family friendly. I think it's the size of the club as we are means that, you know, every fan means something when they come through the doors. So even, you know, in my position, kind of trying to get to know virtually everybody that comes to the doors, and so they've got a friendly face, you know. And we've always been, right from when we started, it's always been around family. And, you know, some kids that haven't got that family support network will see the club as their family, but we try and bring the bridge that across the whole club. So, you know, if for some people, as I say, it's now they're kind of fully bought in, it's part of their weekly ritual. But you've got other families and people that's playing spectators will stay behind and help us close up and stuff. I mean, it's amazing what people will do when they come in. So I think anybody that does come along, I think, number one, I think you'd be entertained. And that's the message I always get from people. Oh, I didn't realise it was this good. I've never seen basketball before. So I think there's that for starters. But then the secondary thing, the guys are doing it on the court. They're being successful. They're playing at a really high level. You know, we hope to represent and be the face of Birmingham around the country for many years to come, really. And you know, there's no reason why we shouldn't be.
Perfect.
Made in Brum.
Yeah.
Well, I have to think so, yeah. Absolutely.
Thanks for your time, mate.
I appreciate it.
If you like this video, please do click to subscribe to the channel. We currently have 5,500 members, over 500,000 views. So let's convert some views into memberships, and that will continue to enable us to bring great guests on and continue making great podcasts. Thanks.